Thank you for being here to worship and celebrate during the Christmas season. We celebrate the birth of our Savior in a manger 2,000 years ago, and we've been doing the Advent reading. Mike's explained that for the last couple weeks, and our theme this week is joy, which is interesting because I've had multiple people remind me you're supposed to smile when you preach on joy, like that's going to be an issue for me. Like I might, you know, I might not be the most, cheery person during Christmas. It might be a reputation that I might have. I'm Weston Ely. I'm a elder at the church. I've been here for a few years, and I get to help preach and teach every once in a while. But I can be known as a little bit of a Grinch when it comes close to Christmas time. I have publicly chastised Mike on Twitter about listening to Christmas music too early. I do believe that is important to contain our holidays in neat packages, you know, starting with the first holiday of the season, which is Halloween, right? That's the first one. Anybody? No? That's my favorite. And then Thanksgiving, a nice two-week package, do Thanksgiving, and then let's give a little buffer zone. And now I can actually think I've stored up enough Christmas joy inside of me that I can now go until Christmas Eve without being a Grinch. I think I've stored up enough before my tank is empty. So I can listen to Christmas music now and I can enjoy it. And so it's going to be interesting with me preaching on joy. My wife has already told me, don't ruin Christmas for everybody. Like, that's not the point of this sermon. I might have asked her, what do you think your biggest idols are during Christmas? Weston, don't ruin Christmas for me. Don't ruin Christmas for everybody. And so we're going to try not to do that. That's not my point, is to ruin Christmas. My point isn't to find the things that you like about Christmas, that I enjoy about Christmas, as I'll share in a minute. And it's not to say, oh, those are terrible, those are awful, but it is to challenge us to think about where are we driving our source of joy from. And so today I want to preface the sermon with, I am for your joy. I believe the Bible is for your joy. I believe God, the Father, the Son, baby Jesus, 8.6-pound baby Jesus, I believe he is about your joy. That's why he came into the world, was so you could experience joy, but exceeding joy. A joy that won't be momentary, a joy that won't be fleeting, a joy that will last forever. And that's what I want to focus on today. But to start off with, I'll just tell you about my Christmas, what makes or breaks Christmas for me, especially growing up when I was a kid. It's all about the presents, right? Like Christmas, to make Christmas great growing up, it was presents. What am I getting this year? I need, and hopefully it's a lot, and hopefully it's all the things I want. And hopefully it's not clothes again, grandma. Like hopefully it's something different, right? Like hopefully it's a video game or whatever that latest thing that you want. For me, it was always video games. Enjoyed opening, the original Nintendo way back when. Just opening my favorite game and like, yes, this is what I wanted. And I can play it for hours now and ignore the person who gave it to me. Like I can just sit there with my tiny little box and play. And that's what Christmas was for me growing up. I had this like, man, gotta have the gifts. My brother, probably not too different from me. I can remember when we were growing up, we would have big family Christmases with a bunch of people would show up and a whole family, big extended family. And I didn't have a huge extended family, but to have everybody there, it felt big to us. You know, it was about three different families that were there, and so we got to see all of our cousins. And I remember a story where my brother, he was probably about five or four, maybe even younger than that, but I think he was like four or five. And back then, Power Rangers was it. Like that was just killing it on the Saturday morning TV shows, and he was all into Power Rangers. And my aunt, who loved him dearly and wanted to buy him a great gift, she went out and got a Power Rangers watch. Remember those watches that had a face on it? And you could flip the face open and you could see what time it was. And this was really cool and hip for a five-year-old. And so he would put this on and she was like, oh, I'm going to get him the perfect present because he watches these guys all the time. Well, By mistake, there were a couple knockoff versions of Power Rangers at the time. There were these weird, like, bug Power Rangers. I'm not even sure what it was, but the face looked different, and it was kind of a cheesy knockoff. Someone trying to capitalize on the Power Ranger movement. It had its own TV show, but my brother hated these guys. It was like rival gangs of, like, Crips versus Bloods. I'm wearing my Power Rangers, and that's this other thing. And so when he opened up the present, he looks at it, and immediately, I hate these guys, like, just immediately blurt out there in the opening of the present. And I just remember, like, oh, that's not what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to wait and tell that to other people later. Don't do that in front of everybody. You know, because I can remember a time where I would get, you know, I knew I was going to get clothes for Christmas. I get it, you know, every year. So you just kind of, you got to accept it. But maybe just ask for a specific type of clothes that you want. So I was like, man, ankle socks, those low-rise ankle socks, that's what I want. If you're going to buy me clothes, get me low-rise ankle socks. And one year I got these mid-rise ankle socks, and my goodness, like, I don't know what. And so I contained it. Thank you so much. I contained it. And then I went in the back, and I was just like, man, I just wish, if they're going to buy me clothes, don't buy me clothes. And I went off on this tirade, and I was 23 at the time. Someone would say. So that for me, for Christmas, what makes or breaks it is the presents. What are some things for you guys? What makes or breaks Christmas? What is it that if this happens, it's a great Christmas? While you're thinking, I don't want any churchy answers. The answer isn't always Jesus. Give me like materialistically, or even family would be good. But what makes or breaks Christmas? If you're like, man, growing up, this was it. If I got this type of present, or if I had this type of experience, what are some things? We'll take a couple. What are some things that make or break Christmas for you guys growing up? Sugar cookies. Yes. What's that? No school. Now, wouldn't that be a bummer if, like, you had to go? I remember, now, I don't know what it was. I always remember having a longer Christmas, and maybe it's because I was younger, but it seemed like when I moved here, and maybe it was a Missouri-Arkansas thing, when I moved here, like, I remember getting out, like, the day before Christmas, and then I remember going back to Christmas, like, the day after New Year's. That's crazy to me. No school is a huge plus. I got a quick story on that. So I went to Missouri Baptist University, okay? And my first semester at Missouri Baptist University, now I think, okay, college kids, you get like what, 5 weeks off for Christmas? Is that a good consensus? Four? At least four, right? At least four? Missouri Baptist had 2.5 weeks off for Christmas. I missed my first 2 days of school. Like, I just assumed I'm not going back on January 3rd. And I was wrong, and I missed two classes because of that. So school off is huge. Anyone else? Christmas music. Okay. Yeah, I will accept it. That's what it does for you. That works for you. And movies. Oh, movies. Yeah, movies are great. We will show a clip here in just a minute. Because, there's lots of great Christmas movies. What are some of the best? Chevy Chase is, yep. What's that, Malachi? Santa Hunters, okay. Did I say that right? I've missed that one. I'll check it out this time. So there's lots of experiences, lots of great things that we can experience and we find joy in. And growing up, we're like, man, this was a constant. You know, we always watched, maybe it was Home Alone. Maybe it was the Chevy Chase growing up. Or maybe it was this video, Christmas Story. We're going to show you a video from it's a montage of a Christmas Story. And in the Christmas Story, you have, is it Ralphie? That's his name? He's looking for a very specific type of gift that this will make or break his Christmas. And so let's take a look. And that is my favorite scene in that movie, is Santa crushing his dreams. So there's a lot of things that we can pin our Christmas experience on, and what happens is if Christmas goes well, if we get for Ralphie, he ended up we've got younger kids. Maybe I won't spoil the movie, if you know how the movie ends, he has his present, but what happens? Is there ultimate joy in that present? And for most of us, if things happen the way we want, he wanted a Red Ryder BB gun. If he gets that toy, it'll make his season. It'll make his Christmas his Christmas for that year. And so for us, when we look, man, I need to have those sugar cookies, I need to have a good time with family, I need to have the great food, I need to watch the movies in this order, and I need to have my experience. I need to have exactly the way I want, because that's going to bring me this level of happiness or comfort or security. There's something about it brings me a level of joy. And for those whom it works out the way they have planned or it works out the way they have hoped, there is joy. There's some sort of benefit or boost or positive emotion that comes out of that. But at worst, if it doesn't work out, if things don't go exactly the way you want it, this season can be depressing for some. In fact, I've had friends where I've had conversations with where they say, you know, it's Christmas is you know, there's parties and family and gifts, and if the gifts stink, or I don't have enough money now as an adult, if I don't have enough money to give the gifts I want to give, or I don't know the people well enough to know what they actually want, or I realize that I'm alone. That Christmas sort of heightens that sense of loneliness. In fact, Psychology Today, they had an article about 4 years ago, said for some people they get depressed at Christmas and even angry because of the excessive commercialization of Christmas with the focus on gifts and the emphasis on perfect social activities. Others get depressed because Christmas appears to be a trigger to engage in excessive self-reflection, and they think about the inadequacies of life. They have a victim mentality in comparison with other people who seem to have more and do more. Still, others become anxious at Christmas because of the pressures, both commercially and self-induced, to spend a lot of money on gifts, to incur increasing debt. Other people report that they dread Christmas because of the expectations for social gatherings with family, friends, and acquaintances that they'd rather not spend time with. And finally, many people feel very lonely at Christmas because they have suffered the loss of loved ones or their jobs, or maybe it's been a long season where there's a sense of loneliness or singleness. And so when it works, it gives us a little bit of a boost, but when it doesn't work, we can become very, very depressed and even angry towards the idea of Christmas. Now, I grew up with a great family home, great Christmases. I don't know why I turned out this way. But other people have legitimate reasons to be depressed and down during Christmas. Because at worst, setting these expectations of this perfect experience, that when we miss the mark or when it doesn't work out exactly the way we want, it leaves us feeling empty and a little hollow, longing for something more, longing for more joy. And I think in even a worst case scenario, that maybe this is what affects me, is that the experience of a good Christmas, the joy is momentary. The joy happens for a second, for a split second. I have kids, and I know how momentary this joy lasts, that the joy of getting my kids the perfect present for Christmas, and they end up playing with the box more than a toy, right? Or maybe 3 months later when they have a birthday. That toy is pushed aside, and now it's all about the new toys they're getting for their birthday. And so we have this sense of expectation, but even if it hits, it doesn't hit for long, and even if it satisfies, it doesn't satisfy us for long. And there's always this need for more joy. There's always this constant battle of how can I infuse artificially, maybe, with buying lots of gifts, spending lots of money on presents, so I can just keep myself from this depressed, lonely state of acknowledging I have very little joy in my life. Now, I made a promise I wasn't going to ruin Christmas for you, right? Okay, so we're going to keep that promise, but we're going to jump over to looking at the gift of joy that God promises his people in the Old Testament. He has a group of people that came from a family, and that family, the patriarch of that family, he made a promise to that I'm going to make you a great nation, I'm going to make your family into a great nation, and I'm going to bless you, and I'm going to use you to be a blessing to the world, to be a blessing to all nations. And so we're gonna look at a point in time when that nation was feeling a lot of external pressure, a lot of pressure from warring nations, nations that wanted to come in from the north and conquer them, and they were scared and worried about what's going to happen. They had pressure from southern nations about we need to ally with these guys or we're going to get attacked from both sides, and maybe these people in the south can protect us from the people in the north. And so they were worried about these wars and rumors of wars and like how can we protect ourselves. And they were in a lot of conflict during that time. Even that family that originally grew into a nation, even that nation was split. and that you had the northern tribes of Israel and the southern tribes of Israel. And so there was even internal conflict amongst this family that grew into a nation. And so we're going to be looking at Isaiah 9, 1 through 7. If you don't have a Bible, grab one on the end of the rows. It'll be on page 487 in that Bible. And we're going to be looking at what Isaiah, he gives a prophecy. Prophecy is both twofold. It is foretelling and forthtelling. It is telling of what God is saying to his people, but it also has a predictive element to it. And in this passage, we're going to see a lot of past tense language. And it's a common thing for prophets to use. Isaiah uses this a lot, where he will speak in the past tense as though a future event has already happened. Because the prophecy that he is relaying is being spoken to us as though it has already happened, as though it is assured to happen. And so we see a lot of past tense language of this is going to happen, and Isaiah is speaking as though these things are so true that for God, it's already in the past. It's already been accomplished. And so we can expect, with great hope, we can expect these things to come true. And in chapter 9 of Isaiah, verse 1, "But there will be no gloom for her who was in anguish," talking about that nation, Israel, God's chosen people, his people that he made from a family into a nation, "that there will be no gloom for her who was in anguish. In the former time," see that past tense? "In the former time, he brought into contempt the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali." And so these are the two northernmost tribes of Israel, where that war is going on, present tense, to Isaiah. Isaiah sees his people and he knows they're worried. He knows they're worried about war. They're worried about being captured and enslaved. And he points out the two most northern tribes that have this ongoing conflict and this fear of what's going to come and capture me. And Isaiah says that for you, that you were brought into contempt, that there was judgment on you. And you were warring, but at the later time, he has made glorious the way of the sea, the land beyond Jordan, Galilee of the nations. That the sea, which has chaos, is a figure for chaos. And he says, the way of the sea, the way that was once chaos, something you once feared, is going to be glorious. And there will be a Galilee of the nations, that the nations will be blessed and brought into the fold with Israel, that there will be a great blessing that happens to all the world. Verse 2, "The people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. Those who dwelt in a land of deep darkness, on them light has shone. You have multiplied the nations. You have increased its joy. They rejoice before you as with joy at the harvest, as they are glad when they divide the spoils." So this is not, he is speaking not to a group of people who are conquered, but a group of people that will have victory. You're going to divide the spoils. You're not going to be on the losing team anymore. Right, Rams fans? You're going to make the playoffs someday. Like, stick with it. There's hope. We're hoping for the future. And he says, you're not always going to be conquered. One day you will be the conquerors. And you will be glad and full of joy. And he gives three reasons why you're going to have joy, why Israel is going to one day have joy when the threat of war and the threat of conquered and enslavement is no longer going to terrorize them to the point that they would look around and say, "God, what are we going to do? We can't trust our God. I have to align myself with another nation. I have to follow another nation for protection." And so Israel is worried and they're scrambling and they're looking to find their joy or security. They're looking to find their hope in something other than God. And God says, one day you will rejoice because of these reasons. Verse 4, "For the yoke of his burden," the oppressor, "the yoke of his burden and the staff for his shoulders, the rod of his oppressor, you have broken as on the day of Midian." These wars, these nations that are bigger than you, they're stronger than you, that they can capture you and enslave you and make you live a life you don't want to live, make you feel uncomfortable. They're not concerned about your comfort. They're not concerned about the power of your nation state. They're not concerned about you as people, but they just want to use you and enslave you for their betterment. That those people, that there is one who will come, that you will break You will break their yoke, you will break their staff, that the rod of the oppressor you have broken as on the day of Midian. Midian is a story from their history that they would look back to, and they would see a man named Gideon who would go into battle against a camp of multiple families, multiple nations, with 300 men. 300 men, I mean, I don't even know, you can barely do a Civil War reenactment. Like, that's just 300 men, what are you going to do with that? That's not a war, that's not a battle. And they go into battle with 300 men, they surround this camp, and they blow trumpets. And God wins the victory for them. That was the battle plan, was let's get 300 men and make a big circle and blow our trumpets. Like, that was the battle plan that God gave them. And so when they look back on the history, and Isaiah says, remember Midian? That's how it's going to be. It doesn't matter if you're weaker. It doesn't matter if you're outnumbered. What matters is God is on your side. And it is God who breaks the rod of the oppressor. So we can know that we're going to have joy in our lives because of how great and powerful God is, and He is on our side. And He tells the Israelites, for every boot of the tramping warrior in battle tumult, and every garment rolled in blood will be burned as fuel for the fire. Now everybody help me out. You guys stop. Okay, stop, like, real loud. Okay, now listen. Okay, so you hear that? That's what it sounds like when an army is warring against you. When an army marches into battle, that's what they said. That's what it sounds like. And so God says, okay, take all these boots and we're going to throw them in the fire. So now everyone take off their shoes and... You're not going to follow me? Okay. Okay. You don't have to take off your shoes, but when you take off your shoes and you make that sound, it's not as intimidating. It actually sounds like children playing. Children run around with their feet off. They don't have these boots that they put on as they're preparing for war. And God says that one day all of these things that were meant for war, that were used in battle, we will do away with them. There won't be a need for this war. There won't be a need for further conflict. And so we can rejoice knowing that when God settles it at the end, that when God says this is, when he brings a peace that will last, that it will not be this momentary winning of a war, but the battle will be secured. And there will be no more need, not even for boots, to be used in battle. And then the third reason he gives us is, for to us a child is born. To us a son is given. Remember, this is in the Old Testament. This is 800 years before Jesus was born. And he says, for to us a son was given. And the government shall be on his shoulders, and his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Many have wondered, what do all these names mean? What is being communicated here? Is it really God that's being communicated, or is there an attack against the Assyrians that's being subscribed in this, that you think you're wise and powerful, but our God is greater? But when you look at all of these names together, there it has to hint at something more than just a human. That there will be a wonderful counselor, a mighty God, which, you know, some people say that just means great hero. But every time in the Bible that is used, it's always in reference to Yahweh, the creator God of everything, the creator God of the universe. And he says, mighty God. He calls this son, this one born, that he will be the mighty God. He will be the everlasting father, which is a really weird name to give if you think of 8.6-pound baby Jesus. It's really everlasting father and prince of peace. Of the increase of his government and of peace, there will be no end. On the throne of David, who is a great king in their history, and over his kingdom to establish it and to uphold it, with justice and with righteousness, from this time forth and forevermore, the zeal of the Lord of hosts will do this. That God is going to accomplish this. That we, as he's speaking to the Israelites, saying, you guys can know you're going to have joy. You can hope in this because God is powerful. Because when he settles a fight, it is done. And that he is sending someone to us. He is sending a son, a person will come to us and be this person who will secure these things. Now, it's interesting. When we think about baby Jesus, we don't always think about the end. You know, we don't always think about Jesus as the conqueror. You know, we see that in Revelation, the last book of the Bible. We see a conquering, we see a mighty God, an everlasting Father, a Prince of Peace. We see that being accomplished in Revelation, but Isaiah assigns it to the manger. Isaiah assigns it to the initial incarnation of God showing up in human form in its most infancy stage. And so when we think about this, we like to go to Luke 2. You might have even heard some of that passage. Luke 2, verse 8 through 12. It says, "And in the same region there were shepherds out in the field, keeping watch over their flock by night. And an angel of the Lord appeared to them, and the glory of the Lord shone around them, and they were filled with fear. And the angel said to them, 'Fear not, for behold, I bring you good news of great joy, and will be for all the people. For unto you is born this day in the city of David a Savior, who is Christ the Lord.'" That unto you is born. We see it right out of the passage, and this will be a sign for you. You'll find a baby wrapped in swaddling clothes, lying in a manger. For unto you a son is born. For unto you this baby will come forth. And so we see the connection that in Luke, who's writing about Jesus' life, he is making the connection from this passage in Isaiah to Jesus' birth and saying, here is the coming king. Here is the one that we have hoped for. And so Luke 2, 8 through 12, it was written, there's 800-year gap between Luke and Isaiah. So for 800 years, the people who read Isaiah, they had to wait 800 years for Jesus to show up. That's a long time for a first step of this plan, of just to have the king show up. And then when we look back and say, well, it's incomplete. There's still something left, that we don't have this eternal, peaceful reign where there is still a need for boots of war. That still happens today. There are still oppressors and oppressed people today. That this ultimate peace has not come. It has not. That there's not a Galilee to the nations. Not all nations have heard of the gospel of Jesus Christ. There's not that these things have not been fulfilled yet. And we see in Isaiah, he is saying that, like, as soon as that baby is born, you have the wonderful counselor. As soon as that baby is there, that is who he is. It doesn't matter if he accomplishes it now or later or 2,000 years later or 3,000 years later, that the birth of that is a sign to us that this is done. That the end of this story reveals to us a time where we can finally have ultimate, unlasting, everlasting joy. I don't know what unlasting would be. But everlasting joy. That we can find that in Jesus who conquers the enemies of Israel, but gives peace to all men, to all nations, as we see in Isaiah verse 1, not chapter 9, verse 1. And so in the meantime, what do? We do the same thing that the original readers of Isaiah did. As we wait for Jesus to come and bring this joy, to bring this peace, we wait and hold fast to the promise, knowing that we've had the sign fulfilled, that Jesus has been born, that the Prince of Peace has come and has given us more promises and more signs to look for. And we can look back on that. We can look back on Isaiah seeing a people for 800 years waiting and longing for the Prince of Peace to be born. And we've already seen him born. We've already seen him conquer death in his resurrection. And now we can hold fast to these promises as the source of our joy, knowing that one day joy will be complete, joy will be fully in us. And now back to Christmas. Okay? So with that in our background, we see there's some similar things between the way we operate in our daily lives where we are constantly looking for something else to bring us joy. Isaiah was talking to a group of people who wanted to find peace, which peace brings joy. Okay? When it's peacetime, it's happy time. When it's wartime, there's not a lot of room for joy. And these people wanted to find their joy by finding peace in their physical, earthly conflicts. And Isaiah says, you're not going to find peace by going and finding another nation to fight this battle for you. You're only going to find peace by relying on the Lord, trusting that he will send a perfect counselor, that he will send a mighty God, that he will send a Prince of Peace. You have to trust in God, hold your hope and joy in that promise, not in the promise of these other nations. And we do this not with other nations. We don't go to Mexico or Canada and say, we don't go to Mexico and say, hey, Canada's giving us trouble. Canada's giving us a lot of trouble. We need your help. We don't go to South America and say, we need South America to help us war because Canada is killing us up here. Like, no one would ever say that ever just because it's a ridiculous scenario. But that's what they were saying. That's what they were doing, is they were turning to the nations below them in the south regions and saying, help us fight these battles, instead of turning to God and saying, my hope is in you, my joy is in you. I know that you will bring about an ultimate peace that will conquer the foes and the oppressors. And we do that as well, where we see God saying, especially during this season, we see God saying, there is joy that you can hope in me. There is joy that is connected with a life connected to me. But we walk through this this commercialized time, and we constantly just being flooded in our minds, the airwaves, seeing commercials and watching the TVs and just having these commercials. And all the commercials are saying, your life would be better if you had this. You would be more secure if you had this. You'd be more comfortable. You'd have more power, more success, more approval from others if you had all of these items in your life. And growing up, I thought my life would be complete if I had more video games. I had low expectations for my life. My life would be complete if I just had this video game. If I could just sit alone by myself and play, and I would have a level of comfort that would be brought to me more so than anything else could ever bring me. I don't know what the deal was with the sock issue, but outside of just being spoiled rotten, but maybe I was like, man, these socks are lame. Everyone's going to think I'm a nerd if I wear these socks. I need the cool socks. I need the cool clothes. I need something better to give me approval with other people. And I'm constantly throughout my lives, as all of us are, we're looking for joy in a different place other than with God. And God says, if you attach yourself to that nation, if you attach yourself to pursuing that idea, that system of thought, if you attach yourself to that and try to find joy and peace in that, it'll be momentary at best, and it'll leave you devastated and depressed at worst. That if everything goes the way you wanted to, if everything happens exactly according to plan, then it'll be great for a little bit. But then you're going to be, at some point in time, a new turmoil is going to come up, or a new warring nation is going to come up, or for us, a new product is going to come up, a new system of thought that we want to gravitate to. I'm done dressing, really nice with a tie and everything, and now the cool thing to do is to wear a sweater vest with the shirt untucked, we're just going to constantly change and change these different idols that are produced in the culture of materialism. And what's the best way to look? What will bring me the most approval? What will show off my power and influence over others? What is going to give me a sense of control in my life? Like, these are the idols that our hearts are pursuing. And God says, you'll never find joy in those things. And at Christmas, we can look at this a few different ways. I want to show you Tim Keller's list of deep idols. He has a book about idolatry and just the things that our heart will gravitate towards. And it's a long book that has a lot of different theological idols. He uses sex and power, and he talks about all these things. But then he gets to the last chapter, and he says these are really the deep heart idols. That when you pursue money, you're pursuing it for a reason. There's a motivating factor as to why you pursue money as your chief end, why you're looking to find joy in money. And it's because of one of four things. It's either power, approval, comfort, or control. This is probably not an exhaustive list, but we see that what he's arguing for is that, you can go ahead and put all of them up there, that he is saying that there's something that lies behind the surface idol, behind the idol of I'm pursuing money, I'm pursuing sex out of marriage, I need to cheat or lie or steal something. Like, I'm pursuing these different things because one of these four things is motivating me. It's driving me to do this. So it's either power. I want to have control over others. that if I get this new job, for some people, getting a new job isn't about having more money to buy more stuff. For some people, getting a promotion and getting a better job is so I can have more control over other people. Because that's what motivates me is standing at the top and being able to tell people what they can and can't do. And for some people, that's a big motivating factor. For others, getting a new job would mean, man, that means I'm approved. There's a sense of accomplishment because my boss looks on me and is favorable towards me and that I have earned his trust. And that can be a driving factor. And for other people, it could be a comfort that I'm going to be able to buy more stuff. I get a promotion, I can buy more stuff, buy more toys, make my life a little easier. Now I can kick back and relax. For some people, this is what they're pursuing retirement for, that I can't wait until I have that relaxation. And then control, that if I get into a new position, I will not have a boss over me or as many bosses over me. I will be able to do life the way I see fit. I will be able to control at least myself. And so there's sort of four different motivating factors for the same idol of money or pursuing money. And so we're going to apply this to different categories in Christmas. That in our hearts, I believe that we probably use all of these at different times, but there are certain scenarios that will bring out at least one of these. And so in Christmas, there are lots of things to freak out about. We read some of them about why people get depressed. There's three main categories is parties, gifts, and family. That for those who you've got the parties you've got to go to, you've got the Christmas party where it has your whole office shows up and maybe you've seen these guys a couple times throughout the year and now you have to go kind of be chummy with them and maybe there's only one person you like. I can't say I feel this way because an office party at Genesis is a narrow group of people, so they might know who I'm talking about. But that's not my, so I swear that's not me. But there's these parties that we can look at. And so if parties is what brings out a sense of frustration or stress, or maybe you find even some joy if it works well, so if you go to parties and you say, man, I need to plan this party perfect. Maybe you're sitting on the planning board. You're the party planning committee, right? And you're like, I have to have, I'm a part of this party planning committee because I want to organize it. I want everyone to walk through the system that I've set. I want everyone to have punch at this time, and I like organizing the schedule and seeing groups of people do what I ask them to do, do the schedule that I've given, play the games that I've set out. I like to organize and be over in charge of people. Now, that's not a bad thing. None of these are bad things. It's not bad to organize and organize groups of people. But we can see that it becomes an idol for us when things don't go well, that we know we're putting way too much stock in the joy of organizing groups of people for parties when it doesn't go according to plan. And my stress level kind of maxes out. And I say, this cannot happen. This is just eroding my power that I had in this scenario. Or for others that are planning a party, it might just be, I want approval. I want people to like my party. The way that my brother and I act towards gifts, can you imagine giving a gift to us? Like if approval was your idol, you'd be devastated. You know, if we get the wrong reaction, you'd be devastated because of, oh, this person didn't like my gift. You know, or for parties, if you made a party, if you're participating in a party and you're just like, man, I don't feel like anyone likes me here. I'm just a part of this. The music's nice. I enjoy it, but no one talks to me. I don't know what the right things to say. I'm looking for approval is what I want. And if someone does approve of me, if someone does befriend me at this party, man, life's great. But if I'm ostracized in a corner, everyone's got their clicks, well, now my approval idol is saying, man, absolutely flatline depressed. Because that party, that aspect of Christmas, I put way too much joy and hope in the approval that I could receive or the power I could receive through it. Comfort and control. I think of gifts. In this scenario, for me, when I look at the gifts that I'll receive, I am wanting comfort. Okay, for me, and yeah, I'm gonna lean towards getting gifts because that's just kind of naturally what I think of. I know it's a season for giving, but that's for other people to work out. I like getting, and for me, it's like comfort. I need this comfort. So if I get a gift that doesn't work for me, man, this wasn't a good Christmas. If I get a gift that was great, I'm putting all my joy, and I had this, oh yes, this is the perfect gift ever. And 3 months later, I'm done with it. But we see that these aspects in our heart that are driving us to put more emphasis and more joy and more hope in these aspects of parties and gifts and family. And family could be a real touchy one. You know, if you want comfort, for me, that's my main motivating factor throughout everything. I am putting all my joy and hope and stock in some sort of comfort I can get. You know, having 3 kids under the age of 6, my Christmases are, I was going to say terrible. I'll say not comfortable. They're not as comfortable as I would like. 3 kids under the age of 6 traveling 10 hours to Southwest Kansas, that's not the most comfortable of environments as I would like. That's why I offer, let me just drive through the night. I will stay up, I'll Red Bull it, and I will drive so everyone will sleep, and it'll be the most comfort I can get out of this experience. And that's what I'm looking for. And so when my comfort level drops at Christmas, when things don't go according to plan, when the party isn't as nice, and maybe it's uncomfortable, or the family interaction between me and some people I haven't seen in a long time, if it's not as comfortable, or I have to now transition from baby little kid Weston to adult Weston, and now I have to care for children, and I can't play as many video games, and I can't do the things I'd like, I can't do the things that make me comfortable, and it stresses me out. And that stress is letting me know, man, I put way too much stock in this thing. I put way too much joy in this idol. I'm looking for joy in a place that the only thing that can satisfy is God, where God is saying, don't look for joy in these other places. Don't look for joy in these other nations. He's just as equally saying to us today, don't look for joy in these gifts. Don't look for joy in these family gatherings or in these parties. Enjoy them. They are great gifts to behold, and they are great gifts to thank God for. But they won't ultimately satisfy us. And so I want to leave us with like this challenge to remind ourselves through this Christmas season, which officially started today. Whatever you did before doesn't count. It officially starts today. I want you to think through, how do I feel a need to have everything organized the way I want it to? Or do I feel a sense that I need to have everything controlled with the gifts I give and the gifts I get and the family parties that I have? Or do I feel I need to have approval? That if someone doesn't approve of me, it's going to depress me. And so when I look at these things, I think, I need to give, and I need to be a part of Christmas, I need to enjoy it, but I need to find, and instead of trying to find power for me, I need to thank God for the organization that He's given me, thank God for the area that He's given me, and ultimately trust that He is most powerful. He is the one I can trust for power. And that approval, that if things don't go the way I want it to, if I don't get, you know, if I give a gift and someone just says, oh, I don't like that at all, which I know no one would, but you can tell on their face. And it could crush you. You know, you could totally crush you. And do I find approval in other people, or do I just want to spread joy and say, I love you, here is this gift? My joy and approval comes from my Father. My joy and approval comes from God, who loves me, who has brought me into His family. And so I'm finding my source of approval to bring me joy in God instead of in the gift-giving experience. And so I want us to think through what that would look like. Where are your heart idols? And I want us to imagine the type of joy that is possible for us to have if we turn it to God. When we look at Matthew chapter 2, verse 9 through 12, we see a picture of it's the Magi, the wise men. They were foreign dignitaries or kings. They had a lot of money. They were very powerful people, and they saw, they watched the stars. And something about the way the stars were, that God even used this these people who were looking to the stars for answers, even used that system of thought to communicate a message that there is going to be a Savior born in a manger as a little baby. He will be the Prince of Peace, and He communicates that to these wise men or these Magi. And so, the Magi go to the local authority, the king. His name's King Herod, and they go to him and they say, hey, we're looking for this baby. We're looking for this one, this great king who's going to be born. Where can we find him? Do you know where he is? And they get all the scribes together and they say, well, our scriptures tell us he's going to be born in Bethlehem. And so they say, well, we saw this star. We believe it's happening now, so we're going to go. We're going to go follow this star and see if we can find this baby king. And if you look, you'll see Matthew 2, 9 through 12. And so after listening to the king, King Herod, he says, hey, when you go find out about the baby, come back and tell me, because I'm King Herod and I might want to know this other king. And King Herod has some nefarious plans. He's not on the up and up. He doesn't want any local uprising, and so he wants to squash whatever other king there might be. And so he says, after listening to the king, the Magi, they went on their way. And behold, the star that they had seen when it rose went before them until it came to rest over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. And going into the house, they saw the child with Mary, his mother, and they fell down and worshipped him. Then opening their treasures, they offered him gifts, gold and frankincense and myrrh. And being warned in a dream not to return to Herod, they departed to their own country by another way. And so here you have three foreign dignitaries that they could make a lot of inroads if power was what they really wanted. If they wanted to really align themselves with King Herod and get more power, another foreign ally. But instead, they went a different route. They went out the back door so King Herod couldn't find them. And so they kind of burned a bridge there. But they said, man, the joy I have in worshiping this baby who we know is the king, the joy I have in that is greater than the joy I could have from the power that I would get by aligning myself with King Herod. Or it could be approval, you know, just knowing that, man, we upset this other dignitary from this land, that he's not going to approve of us. We're not going to be friends anymore. We were hanging out. He was kind and gracious and gave us a place to stay while we were looking for this star. But we distanced ourselves from him. We went another way. They found more joy in the approval of Jesus and the approval of God through worshiping baby Jesus than they could from the approval of King Herod. Or comforts. Maybe they could have had a finder's fee, you know. Turn in baby Jesus to get murdered and get a sack of gold. I don't know. He probably would have offered something. And they turned that down, so much so that they turned down any type of reward or anything. They gave gifts. They said the gift from this gold or this frankincense or this myrrh, these gold incense and cologne or perfume, and they gave these things that were precious and very valuable at the time, so valuable that it probably allowed them Joseph and Mary and Jesus to escape, because Herod later on started killing all the babies that were Jesus' age, and they escaped to Egypt. That had been an expensive trip at the time. And so these expensive gifts that they gave, they say, I'm not going to find my joy in these possessions. My joy is in Jesus. My joy is in worshiping God. Or they could have found a sense of control. Maybe it just didn't fit. You know, the route they went to get home, they had to go a different way. Well, they already knew the way to go back. And maybe they could have even gone a shorter way had they not been worried about bumping into Herod again. But they said, no, we're going to go out of our way. We're going to go a different route. We're going to make sure he doesn't see us. It doesn't matter if it fits my schedule. They made this long trip just to worship him. They were from very far off. And so when they saw power, approval, and comfort, and control, like these were things that they were saying, I'm not going to find this in these other places that the world has to offer. I'm not going to find my joy in what the world is offering, my power, or my control, or my comfort, or my approval. But I'm going to find my joy in God. And that's what God tells the people of Israel in Isaiah. That's what we see played out in the birth narrative of people falling down and finding their joy in Jesus. And that's what I want to challenge us today. As the band comes up, we're going to sing more songs of joy. And when we think about joy, I want us to think about that this isn't just a place that we find joy. It's not gifts, family, Jesus, and parties. It's all these things, family, gifts, the whole Christmas season, even the songs, they're good gifts. They're good things for us to enjoy. But our ultimate joy comes from Jesus. Our ultimate satisfaction comes from Jesus. So whatever it is for you, whatever you look forward to most in the holiday season, whether it's impressing people or getting the approval of people or being comforted or just having it exactly the way you want, whatever it is about the holiday season, I hope that you will join us in trying to find our joy in Jesus and remembering that Jesus is the reason that we will have everlasting joy forever. And so stand with us as we sing another song, and I'll pray. Lord, we thank you for this time. We thank you for giving us the gifts of this season that remind us of you. I pray that every gift that we get and give, every song that we sing, that every sugar cookie that we eat, that everything will remind us of your goodness, that everything will point towards you as our King. And Lord, we love you and thank you, and just I pray that you would give us hearts that are set on finding joy in you. In Jesus' name, amen.